Hello, hello everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Palace Way podcast. And what a week it is, coming off the back of a 5-2 win. Strange scoreline, one we don't really see often either, against London rivals West Ham. And joining me to unpack it is a man who's back for his hat trick. Not JP, unfortunately. That wasn't to be. But joining me again is Tampa Palace himself, Pat. Welcome back. How you been?
Been good, man. Let's keep it going. If this is the results that we're going to have.
Basically, are you like our good luck charm now? Because the way I see it, I mean, that's three unbeaten when we've had you on the show now this time of the season. So, I mean, you must be a good luck charm, right? I mean, it was certainly a performance to behold. And, you know, it's not just you for once joining me. We do have extra company, a name we haven't had on this podcast for a long time. But those of you that have been following us from the start may remember we were quite a broad forum. We opened up to all of our members and we've had, you know, all sorts of guests affiliated with the Palace Way on the show. So joining myself and Pat is Sam, one of our social media editors. And it's good to have you back again. How you been, mate?
Yeah, not too bad. I mean, it's better than we were last time I was there.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it feels like such a throwback. You know, we're talking about Semenyo, we're talking about the window. It was a real throwback. But really good to have you back up to speed. It's been a while since we last spoke. So again, I mean, Sam, just initial feelings. Like, let's just forget the analysis for now. I want a little bit of a headline from you. I mean, how are you feeling after that performance? Because we don't really get to talk about scorelines, as I said earlier, this often. And I think there is something to be said for that in terms of how that energizes a fan base. So how are you feeling?
I pretty much spent the entire game with my head in my hands for once in a good way because I actually couldn't believe what I was seeing. It went
It was a
from,
strange euphoria, wasn't it? Yeah.
yeah, it said something that ground was almost as quiet as it was. I don't think anyone really understood what was going on because it was almost like we were celebrating for a goal every 5 minutes.
It was a little bit out of our skin, and just a little fact, that was the first time we'd gone 4-0 up within 31 minutes. It's the fastest we've ever scored those amount of goals in our history. So in terms of starts to a game, it's pretty electric. And I think it sums up what we've been saying on this pod for a long time in terms of using both data and the eye test, as you like to say, Pat, to defend Glasner's new style of play. And speaking of, I want to talk a bit about the tactics coming into this game. In my mind, it always felt like it was going to be a very much a possession-based Glasner style against a counter-attacking Moyes style. And I was always curious as to how those two styles would interact with each other and who would win key duels, who would dominate the midfield, and so on. So, Pat, have you got any thoughts on the overall approach to that game? How you felt Glasner set up, how you felt we exploited areas strongly, perhaps areas where we weren't so good. Just give me your thoughts a bit about the tactics.
A lot of it was what we predicted it would be, sit back and counter. But there's ways where you can drop back and have a very active, high, not high press, but intense press, even from a low block. And then there's times where you can just kind of sit back and wait for your moment. And it seemed the latter was happening with Moyes. Even more so than the possession was about 60-40. Field tilt, which remember is all the touches inside opponent's final third. So it's really where the ball is, not depending who has possession at that time, but where the ball is on the pitch and which final third was around 70, 75% for Palace. So totally dominated the ball in their third. Every time you turned your head, you looked like you missed an opportunity. It was crazy. So it was one to pay attention to, one to certainly not turn your head away from. Just a lot of action, a lot of getting chances, pressing high. One thing you could see was outside center back. So Richards and Klein would almost pinch in and follow their man in to try and make a tackle. That started up the second goal, I believe. It was a Richards tackle that had us leading onto goal. So just some really aggressive, direct attacking play.
Phenomenal in many ways. It was we haven't really seen attacking play like that for some time. I was in kind of disbelief looking at the notifications coming through about the goals. I don't know about you guys. Like, it kind of just reminded me of 5-1 leads and, you know, sort of beer gardens in the summer. We actually had good weather here for once. So, you know, it was a real throwback in many ways to that kind of strangely unpalace performance. But I think in a more tactical sense, you're right. I mean, there were so many things that we could sit here and unpack. And I think the centre back is a really good starting point. Chris Richards, we'll get onto him. He had a phenomenal individual performance, really locked up Mohamed Kudus. But I want to talk a bit about Nathaniel Clyne specifically, because I think before we start looking at the goals, because let's be honest, we should. I mean, some of them were phenomenal. I think it was really worth talking about. But Nathaniel Clyne, let's go back. He's been drafted into this kind of makeshift right centre back role. As you say, he's been coming in and pinching a lot. He's never really played in that role in his career. And bearing in mind, he's what, sort of is approaching his mid-30s now. You know, he's really getting on and he's somehow found this new lease of life in this sort of makeshift position. So talk to me a bit about that, Patrick, because I want to kind of just unpack that a little bit more.
You're really starting to see him get comfortable in a position where he's not being asked to do much more than he can offer in a good way. We're utilizing the things he's good at and kind of dispelling his weaknesses a little bit. So we know he's got some pace to him. We know his instincts are good, but he's never going to be one to really get aerial duels. He's not going to jump high. He's not going to do that. So we have Munoz and Anderson Faulkner. And we have Wharton, who's, if you looked at Wharton's heat map from this match, he was in that defensive half space, kind of where the outside central defender would sit quite a bit. And that's showing that he was tracking back, making sure there was coverage if Munoz got forward and there wasn't somebody to play that secondary position to Klein. Anderson playing next to him continues to do a good job. And we can use him to get forward a little bit more. We can use him to break up some of those pacier wing guys that we didn't have an opportunity to slow down before. So it also allows Munoz to get more on the ball. He had 114 touches this match. I think the next most was in the 80s for either team. So just to show you how involved Munoz was, because he had some defensive stability behind him too. All of that goes to show how well we've been able to utilize the strengths that Klein offers, but trying to shadow away from and protect those weaknesses.
I mean, Sam, just speaking of individual ability, I mean, one thing I find fascinating is Glasner's ability to transform individuals. He's very good at talking, I think, in the press about the collective effort and trying to stay away from talking about individual displays. And the fact that even Glasner felt the need to single out Klein, I felt, was quite telling. But let's talk about JP, because I think before we look at his actual goals and we get into, like I say, all the goals that were covered, he's a man, he's found a new lease of life, frankly. You know, 6-8 for him under Oliver Glasner. I mean, how impressed have you been with him?
The thing is, he came to us and we saw very quickly that he could finish when given opportunity, like given chances. And we're seeing more and more he is given chances under his system. And that's almost the entire game of Glasner is getting the ball into the box, getting even half chances to snatch at, which is what JP has throughout his career with us, even when struggling to score prolifically, would still score almost the most ridiculous half chances where the ball just glanced at him. But not just that, his whole round game has completely changed. Like, I was sat there, I was just watching him play balls into, like, in behind channels for Elise, Munoz, Eze to run onto. Mm. And I was just remembering, like, we've seen this man fall over the ball, trying to pass the ball quite frequently, like, throughout his career. And within a couple months, 3 months now of Glasner being here, he's completely changed him into a player that's not just has the ability, but is confident enough to be trying to play those like precise in-behind balls that you'd expect to be seeing from someone as creative De Bruyne, instead of the big target man that we all sort of saw Mateta as.
It's been a real transformation, hasn't it, stylistically? I mean, not only is he working harder, but I think, as you say, that confidence is such a big part of his game. Just completely off the pitch, I'm going to talk more holistically here. He's someone who I think is increasingly going out of his shell a bit more. And I think he's very popular within the squad. And you know, the way in which the media, or at least the fan media, is portraying him, I think, is phenomenal too. He's sort of won our hearts a bit. And I think he feeds off of that. There's kind of a positive loop that's going on here, whereby he's scoring goals, he's winning hearts, and then he's in itself playing with more confidence. I mean, it's just really fascinating to see. So, you know, really happy for him. It's really, really encouraging to have that defined kind of number nine who's actually scoring goals for us. But, you know, there's so many more goal scorers within this squad. And as far as offensive performances go, I think we know it was pretty phenomenal. So, Pat, I'll bring you in here. Let's just talk about the Elise goal first, because we were talking about centre-backs just then. And I think the way in which Anderson in particular was used as part of that pinch, and quite a dynamic pinch as well in terms of personnel, was really fascinating. So talk to me a bit about what happened for that goal and what you found particularly interesting about it.
Yeah, first of all, just to kind of bookend what you guys are saying about Mateta and the way he can, you know, he's finally getting his chances to get onto dangerous balls and things like that. As always, the eyes and the numbers, they can validate each other. They can prove each other wrong. It's how you connect things. So the amount of passes or carries into the box that we've had since Glasner's come has gone up around more than 30%. So you're talking like four or five more entries into the other opponent's penalty area per match. And obviously the more times you're getting in there, the more chances you have to shoot. And a striker, a good nine that's in form, should be the person that's the recipient of those opportunities, those chances, and you're seeing more goals. So it's just another opportunity to show where numbers and eye tests are not the opposite thing. They put things together. So there's that. But with Elise and that goal, I mean, it just shows another opportunity where they're understanding positioning. I mean, we're rotating through. We got guys dropping back. Like I said, Wharton would drop back to find a push up in certain moments of the match. Hughes was pushing forward and doing a fine job with it. And, you know, just Anderson with that beautiful back post, little chip. You knew somebody was going to get onto it. And luckily it was Elise.
Thank God it was Elise. I mean, if there's anyone you trust to remain composed in that situation, I mean, it has to be him, right? It's a very kind of subtle flick to not it past Fabianski, but I think you have to get that spot on. And at the pace at which the ball's whipped into him, I mean, there's not really a lot of margin for error there. So really, really, really good to get that in. And, you know, he's someone who really fascinates from a statistical standpoint. I can get these up for hand and edit it out if necessary, but just a comparison here for you versus Bukayo Saka, who is someone I think, for rightly or wrongly, it just seems to be compared to him a lot. Elise outclasses Saka for non-penalty goals per 90 by 1.18, assists per 90 by 0.12, shot creating actions per 90 by 0.55, which is pretty significant, and then take-ons per 90, 1.78. So don't get me wrong, Bukayo Saka is a phenomenal player. I'm not even going to suggest on here that Saka is better or worse. I just think they're a really, really similar profile player. And I think, you know, the numbers that Elise is putting up is really, really phenomenal. I know you have to connect the dots, as you say, Pat, and that is completely true. But I think from a creative standpoint, I think Elise is putting up genuinely world-class figures at his age. I've seen similar statistics comparing him in the same leagues as Rafinha and Vinicius Junior, because he's simply ranking that highly across Europe in a very competitive league. I mean, he goes from strength to strength. But I'll digress. I think there's more to talk about than just Elise himself. As phenomenal as he is and as great a game as he had pretty much all round, I think Eze is, again, another person that we really need to put the spotlight on. Because, I mean, again, Sam, I'll bring you in here on this. Just talk us through that goal, because, I mean, we haven't seen one of those for a long, long time.
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever actually seen us score a bicycle kick. Well, I mean, other than the few that Wilf has scuffed, what astounded me with the goal in particular was the amount of power he gets on it. It's like, in that situation, if we're honest here, he could probably have headed it in and been a lot more safe with it. But I think it speaks quite like volumes to the fact that he got even attempted to go for that, because I assume he like saw it as an easier way, or a more guaranteed way of scoring. And it's just, again, going back to it, the amount of power he puts on it from such a short distance is ridiculous. Like in the replays, the camera can barely catch it. And if it wasn't in one frame, I generally don't think the camera would be able to keep up with the ball. And it's just looking at it, you almost lose it with your eyes. But not just his goal, like Eze was unplayable that game. His finishing, other than that, wasn't at his very best. He's put quite a few wider over the bar, but he just played the game as if he knew he was better than everyone else he was playing against. And it's interesting with Eze, because it does take him a good 3 or 4 games back after injury to get back into it. But once he's there's not many players or teams that could really put a glove on him. By the time we were 3-0 up, you could see in the West Ham players that they just did not want to go near him. Like they were constantly, their midfield would step off him, and he'd have more and more space, which just then made him have more and more availability and freedom to just run through their entire team. And going down to it, for their last goal, the assist, whilst obviously all the highlight is on his nutmeg, he drives from halfway inside their own half to inside their box without being even challenged, because no one wants to go near him. The only person who did is attempts to foul him, and he rides the challenge in a way that we used to see Zaha do quite a lot. And it's a statement to him that whilst it does take him a second or a couple games to get back to fitness, once he is fit, he just is on another level, and you start to see why teams like City are interested in him.
No, definitely. I mean, he was linked with, what, a £60 million move. Never happened, of course, but I know the interest is there. That's something that's quite well documented. And, you know, it's not hard to see why. I mean, he offers a lot of flair and X factor that you simply don't see with many players. There are comparable qualities in others, but I don't think anyone does the glide quite like him. You know, like you say, his movement and his ability to sort of almost dodge challenges, and it feels second to none, genuinely. We're going to miss him. I really, really think he'll be up for sale in the summer. I very much think so. But, you know, it'd be a real shame. He really, really took the game by the scruff of his neck. And I think the way in which he interacts with Elise is just phenomenal. We know how much they kind of need each other. Maybe that's a bit harsh. I know there are plenty of other creators in that squad, but I think they seem to bring each other to another level. I really, really want to draw attention to that, because it's really encouraging to see him back. And as you say, there's a bit of a cycle that goes on, isn't there, with Eze? I mean, you've seen that graphic that we talked about before. He kind of goes through spells where he's just returned from injury, and then he's kind of, you know, has a few poor games. People start to say he's washed, sell him, all the rest of it. Suddenly goes on to have amazing form of his life, and then he pulls his hamstring. So, you know, it's the Palace way. Oy. One thing I really want to raise as well is just for that third goal. I mean, it was probably not worth dwelling so much on, because I want to get through them, but And it is really unfortunate by Emerson to put that in the back of the net. I have to admit, from their perspective, probably not great. But I mean, it does come from a lot of sustained Palace pressure, and I think we need to sort of take our glory out of that. So, Pat, I mean, just talk about the own goal as well, because I mean, how did you find that came about, and how did you find it from a tactical standpoint?
Just, well, first off, annoying because it would have been Munoz's first goal. We took away his first goal from him. So nice job, Emerson, there. But really, it goes to show our wing backs played, we played like a true front attacking five. This is one of the first matches that we really just went out for it. I think a lot of it was to do with West Ham being so passive and allowing us to essentially pin them back. But it wasn't really taking turns between Mitchell and Munoz. They both were playing in almost a front five attacking line. And when we would lose possession, we would counter press from those positions. And that's essentially what you were seeing, was winning those balls back and being able to make a switch to the other side, getting them to overcommit to having players on their half and hitting the far post on a numerical advantage. We've been playing that way for a few matches now under Glasner, and that's what we were going for. Obviously, a little bit of uncertainty on what to do with that cross in, whether the keeper should go for it or not. And from our vantage point, we'll take it. But yeah, it was still a product of putting some serious pressure on them, allowing our wing backs to not alternate, but to really play both pinning themselves deep into the attacking third and creating a lot of chaos.
Definitely. I mean, I've said before that first Munoz goal is going to hit sweetly because it's been coming, and he's been increasingly more confident and making an impact at it's seemingly every level, whether it's against Luton or Liverpool. He really seems to find a new way to step up a gear offensively, and the way he's adapted to this league is it's been increasingly seamless. I think there were some doubts first game or two, but I think now it's just he's very, very quickly got up to speed and looks like a very, very shrewd acquisition. Tariq Mitchell, I don't know if you have any particular stats on him, Pat, by the way, but I think he's someone that not even have a bad game by any means, but I think a lot of people stole the show. It was a very competitive man of the match and so on. So many great individuals, but he kind of went under the radar, I think. But that left side is still a valuable part of our system, isn't it?
Yeah, he went under the radar just because of how valuable and how successful our right flank was last match. I think we went down that way to attack around 52% of the match. Our attacks went through the right side. So I think part of it was a product of every time West Ham would win possession, they would immediately try and bomb it to their left to try and pick on our back right side, our back flank with Klein there. And then they would lose possession and we would just see, okay, path of least resistance is to start on the side and go through it. We were just having success on that side. We weren't going much down the left. As I was getting the ball more when he was dropping really centrally and trying to get almost in areas that a true 10 would be playing. And the only time we really used that left flank was for a lot of those big switches and kind of finishing blows off of some deeper builds. But for the most part, we played on that right side. And that's probably why you didn't, if you think back in the match, you probably don't have that moment of Mitchell doing something exceptional. But that's just because he didn't touch the ball as much as he has in previous matches. I think still overall positioning was well, got forward. No one really beat him. He never was switched off or anything like that. So just quieter, but not necessarily worse.
No, definitely. I think that's a really fair assessment. I think, quietness, I think whether it's from the stats standpoint, from the headlines in terms of goals, I think quietness is never necessarily an awful thing. And, he's someone who I think gets a lot of scrutiny, as we said on the last episode. And I think, again, he really held up this time. And I think we need to give more credit where it's due. He has adjusted very well to this league and increasingly under the system too. He's simply not as offensive as Munoz, and I think we need to cut him a bit of slack. But one person who also impressed, and before we look at the goals, I think I really want to give this man credit before I forget. Chris Richards, come on, guys. We've got Americans on this call, whether it's just sort of CJ, who you won't know, by the way, as a listener sitting in a recording, or Pat. We've got a big American contingent now, so I'm quite happy to bring in Chris Richards. We actually had Mikey from Matchday 365 on ages ago, who's from Birmingham, and he really loves having like a local hero in the squad. But I mean, just how impressive was he, particularly coming back from injury after a very late fitness test? I mean, Pat, come on, I'm going to give you the spotlight again for obvious reasons. Hey, how did you find him?
Oh man, first of all, the fact that he is one of the most unanimously loved players on the entire squad by supporters, that really no one dislikes him, is one of the greatest things. Because he is, I'm glad everyone sees how good he is and the passion he puts in, because we've seen it for a long time. You would see him darting into the midfield, those central areas, whether it was out of possession to try and break up, links and play with West Ham or kill off counters. or whether it was in possession when he was trying to make some kind of deeper runs, trying to go into those kind of outer box areas, outside the box, trying to be a little chip into the play or make a little marauding run. You know, he offers those things that we forget when we don't have him and we kind of miss it. And then he reminds us of his threat on the ball, off the ball, the little things he can do. Yeah, I'm obviously a little biased, but I love the guy. I hope he continues to do well for us and make us proud over here.
He's really come back seamlessly into the team. I mean, Sam, I want to bring you in here because I'm aware I've sort of shone the spotlight away from you a little bit. I mean, how did you find Chris Richards' performance, just to add on to that?
I mean, I thought he was brilliant on the weekend. I'm almost confused on what we should do when Lerma's back, and obviously Gaye's back, because both Lerma and Richard are playing in like at such a high level for the same position. And obviously Lerma is more naturally a midfielder and he'll probably go back there this season. However, like if we're pushing on next season, assuming we keep the back line as we have, it's a massive toss-up between the two, because as much as Rich is impressed, I don't think there's doubt that Decore and Wharton will probably end up being on midfield next year. But Lerma is such a body in the team, and he pushes into midfield when he's in the defensive role, same way Richards does, but obviously to a more natural level being a midfielder himself. But then again, you see Richards and he's so dominant at times, like physically. Antonio, who is a nightmare for defenders at times, being so like fast and strong as he is, and Kudus, who is like has been unbelievable this season, as we looked at as one of the like unanimously best players outside the top six, to be kept that quiet by Richards coming back from such a late medical check is making such a like welcome problem for us to have that level of quality in depth that we just don't have in many other positions.
Mad, isn't it? The idea that we actually have a problem with depth, having too much depth in any way, in some ways, is just, it's unheard of. We've been starved of that. And I keep using that word on every episode, it feels now, but we've just missed that. We don't really have these kind of selection headaches. You just don't hear about it in a Palace context. I just want to really touch on your point there, because I thought it was really good about that individual battle with Kudus. Some key stats on Kudus's performance. No goals and assists, obviously, but no key passes, shots on target or crosses from someone of that ability. And again, no disrespect to him. He's been brilliant for West Ham, a really, really good pickup. You know, a real, real engine in defence for them. Only 1 in 5 take-ons were completed. He lost all but 2 of his duels and he made 13 for context as well. So that's a really, really poor rate. Offside 3 times and he lost possession 14 times as well. I mean, it's just... Wow, it's a terrible individual performance, by the way. I really, really have to give credit where it's due to Mikey, a friend of the pod, by the way, for posting that. I know he's got a reputation, and we joke about it as being kind of a Captain America propaganda merchant. But, you know, it has to be said it was a fantastic comeback in every sense. And, you know, I think it really deserves particular praise. It is nice to be taking a very positive tone by default. Actually, we don't really get to do that, as I said at the start, very often. But I think we should get back to the goals, because simply put, there's still more to unlock here. We're sort of 3 out of 5. And again, it's not every day we're going to get the chance to look at 5 goals. So I think, you know, if Match of the Day can't do us justice, and you'll definitely know about that, Sam, then I think we should at least try to actually look at some detail of what actually happened. So without further ado, I think we'll continue and just look at those goals. So, Sam, 2 goals from that big, beautiful board man, Jean-Philippe Mateta. He's won our hearts. He's won yours. Talk to me about those 2 goals, because they are slightly different, I think. One of them takes a lot more time and one of them doesn't. So, yeah, talk to me about that.
They're both goals that you see him score quite often. One's sort of the first one with Eliseu playing the ball into him. It's sort of in his stride, takes it first time, I'm pretty sure, into the opposite corner, beats the keeper. It's a proper, like, striker's finish. It's what you want from him. At times, you have your gripes with him of not taking the chances he really should be taking. It's just more of the same. It's more of what we've been seeing with him recently. Obviously, going back to the City goal, it's quite similar to that. Picking his spot and finishing across goal. And then obviously the second one, the ball was played into him. He had a lot more time to think about what he wants to do with it. Stores on the ball and puts it in a position that is much harder for a keeper to get a hand to instead of just lashing it, which is what you'd expect him of a few months ago to do, really. And I think there's just testament to how far he's improved, that both situations that we had seen him get into loads before playing under Glasner, obviously, However, the frequency that of chances that we've been giving him recently, and obviously whatever they're working on the training ground, you can see that he's more confident and comfortable with those types of situations, both of them being a lot more composed than what we would have expected of him up until this recent run of form.
It's been a bit of a running joke, isn't it, that Mintasa, when he has to use his brain, is a bit crap. And actually, I think that misprint is spelled anyway, because, I mean, off the ball, for one, he's been incredibly intelligent for a long time, and I think particularly more so under Glasner. But I think, you know, that second goal, I think, epitomised that improvement, because, you know, he really did well to get himself onside. I genuinely thought it was off, you know, when I was looking back. I was kind of surprised that he managed to do that in time. It's just not something we think about. He is a bit of a poacher, but I think, you know, he's someone who I think thrives best when he's subliminal. Even he kind of just has to use his instinct. He takes those one-touch finishes. I think when he has to sort of get a bit technical and do it all on his own, he normally falls flat. And I think it's more the anomalies that he scores them from rather than the kind of the mean. So it was really, really good to see this kind of that brace have a bit of contrast in style. A really minor point, because the real headline here is that he's just got two more goals. He's one off double digits. He's scored more goals, by the way, this season than he has in any other season combined. You know, this is by far his spotlight. You know, this is his time to shine, and we're all basking in the glory, aren't we? So really, really pleased that we feel like we've got a number nine back, you know, a proper striker that we can rely on. I wanted to end a bit on this point by talking about the kind of Weghorst Colomwani arc that we joked about under Glasner, where, you know, big tall target man goes to Frankfurt and becomes world class and sold for big money under Glasner. Now, someone said on Twitter, I think it's Whiteley Vigor, would you take 50 million for him? Kind of as a joke, I guess, but whether it was or wasn't, not the point. I mean, everyone would take 50 million for him, let's be honest. But I mean, there is a real symbol there in that this is someone who I think has come leaps and bounds in a very short space of time. And I think we can be really, really excited by him. But I want to move on and talk a bit about an unfortunate Dean Henderson howler, because again, he's someone who I think simply won't go away in terms of controversy. I think last week, you know, won a lot of hearts, and we really managed to see the best of him in that game against Liverpool. You know, and to keep a clean sheet in the way he did was just, I mean, it was sublime. It was a really, really outstanding performance. I think everyone knows that. We talked about it a lot on the pod and went through all the statistics. But I mean, Pat, we've had this debate before, so I'm not going to unlock that Sam Johnston, Dean Henderson thing. But what did you think of the howler itself? Because I think there is something to be said about it.
As I said when I was watching it go in, it would be something that we would really have to be talking about if it was a 2-1 lead or a 3-2 or something like that. But luckily, it was 5-1 at the time, so we can sit here and laugh about, yikes, how bad it was. It was just not really much to be said about it. Completely, almost like forgot he could use his hands or couldn't use his hands. So he had to pull his hands back. And then by the time he realized that, the ball was in the net type thing. I don't know. Not good, but thankfully we built a big enough lead up that we're not sitting here, you know, really, really having to discuss it.
Unfortunately, I have to say this, I'd be a bit scared about the abuse he'd be getting again on social media if it was, like I say, something that would actually define the result of that game, which on another day could easily have done so. But, you know, if that's football, unfortunately, sometimes mistakes do happen. I'm fairly sympathetic, to be fair. I think Glasner was quick to jump on this and say, look, he's earned the right to make that. You know, it's not great, but he has earned the right. You know, he kept us in at Anfield. He's responsible for that win in many ways. And, you know, with all due respect, it just didn't have a meaningful outcome on the points tally. So he gets a bit of slack, I think, for that from Glasner. And I think I personally just, you know, we all make mistakes. We all have, you know, jobs, careers, studies, whatever. We all get things wrong sometimes. We all have massive howlers. I've done things before, like it happens. Doesn't mean it's great. Doesn't mean it should happen again. It's not a pattern we'd like to see. And, you know, there is an expectation of someone of Henderson's ability to do better. But, you know, it has to be said, I think we're not going to gain anything out of, you know, we're getting really nitpicky about that, because there's very little chance that he repeats this. It's just something that happens. We've seen plenty of howlers in our time as Palace fans. I think we all know that. Sam, do you have anything to add on that?
To be honest, I am quite critical of Henderson at times. I think he's been much improved recently. This isn't something really to jump on. We were 5-1 up. The game was pretty much done. We were seeing it out at that point. And it's a lapse of concentration from a keeper who hadn't had anything to do all game. He's under so much scrutiny with the debates around him with Johnson and obviously his price tag. Any mistake is going to be jumped on, especially one as big as that.
For whatever reason, we really decided to put an extra level as a fan base onto him in terms of scrutiny. I think, like you say, there's a lot of factors that caused that. And, you know, I think we just have to kind of move on a bit. I just want to take a little look at early player of the season shouts, because I think there's so many players that could be in for this category, particularly under Glasner. I think we've seen the best of so many players. But we have to forget there was a Roy Hodgson season as well here. You know, a season of two parts. And I think even in the thick of that, even at our lowest, I think there were some real, real highlights there. And players that shone through, particularly Jordan Ayew, I want to give a shout out to, who maybe hasn't been the best under Glasner. We'll talk about substitutions maybe, but Sam, I'll bring you in here. Have you got any particular shouts you'd like to put in for your sort of player of the season?
Yeah, I mean, I have two. I'm very vocal about how much I love them, those Romida, Lerma and Mitchell. Either one, I think, is deserving of it. They've both been unbelievable under both Hodgson and Glasner, which is something the other shouts that I see quite often can't really be said for. IU was brilliant under Hodgson at times, but hasn't done it too much under Glasner. I'm sure that's just him learning the system. And Mateta was, again, brilliant under Glasner, but was pretty woeful at times under Hodgson. Mitchell was 7 out of 10 game, pretty much every game under Hodgson, and he is rapidly improving and being one of our better players most weeks under Glasner. And Lerma leaves nothing out on the pitch. I'm pretty sure he'd put his body in the way of a truck if it meant getting a clean sheet. If he isn't player of the season, he's definitely signing the season. The only other one that I can really see getting thrown into the conversation is, despite his limited play time, there is no one at the club quite as good as Elise is, but I don't think you can really give it to him with the amount of injuries he's had to deal with this season.
Pat, I'll bring you in here as well. I think Lerma, and it's okay if you want to be boring or whatever and like go for Lerma, but I think Lerma is probably, if I was a betting man, I'd be putting a tenner on Lerma winning quite a few of those sorts of awards. So say what you want, of course, but I mean, who do you think is your early sharper player of the season?
Yeah, I can't disagree with much that you're saying over there. So I'll, give my votes to those guys too, but I'll also kind of offer up a couple other guys that we haven't talked about that I think are having really good seasons, maybe up to possibly being player of the season type things for us. Mateta, I'm putting in there because even though he was non-existent for the first 20 or so matches, especially when Hodgson was there, he's our leading goal scorer in the Premier League. He still is. And if he gets one more, he's our first striker that's in double digits for league goals since Benteke. So that's a pretty big deal. It's amazing. You got to wonder, what could he have done if he was in this type of system playing in this confidence? Is that possible to sustain over the course of a year? But I don't know, but I'd like to have seen that tried. So I think he has to even be considered a little bit despite not having a great beginning of the season. And then the other one is Richards. Obviously, again, shameless American. But he was the one that filled in for right back. He was the one that filled in at defensive midfield. He was the one that filled in at center back when he was needed. He had versatility to get us through some really rough periods and try and see out maybe a point here and there, maybe 3 points here and there, before January hit. So just because he's been out of the picture for a little while, I think we forget how important he was for us down the stretch when we were kind of held together by string. And he was one of the only people that was really pushing on for us and really staying durable against his stereotypical assumption of him, so shall we say. But overall, I think he needs to be considered too. The kid's been great, shows just as much passion as a guy like Lerma does, just as tough, just as physical. I mean, I'm not saying not to Lerma. I love Lerma too, but let's give the young kid, Richard, some love too. He's been willing to play anywhere and put his heart in his sleeve and do everything.
No, that's true. We've said that a lot about Lerma, but I think Richards is absolutely worthy of the same kind of praise in a very similar light. He's come in where we've needed people most and through some very tough periods and some very tough games, both as a watch, as fans, and actually on the pitch itself. He's just sort of found a way to give it his best and, put in a fairly decent string of performances. I want to give a particular shout out to Daniel Munoz. I feel incredibly sorry for him because he's had a fantastic season. But if you think about it, he won't win player of the season. He won't win January signing of the season because of Adam Wharton.
Yeah.
And he won't win Colombian of the season because of Jefferson Lerma. So he's really kind of, it's a shame. He's so brilliant. And yet I don't think he's quite number one in any category, which sucks. I mean, even right backs, like probably maybe that at a push. Yeah, probably. But like Nathaniel Klein's coming in for late fucking title charge on that, isn't he? It's just Daniel Munoz, though, again, another brilliant, brilliant player. Again, I won't actually be giving him player of the season, unfortunately, unless he goes and scores like five from right back at the end or something and finally gets his cover to 12. He is someone, though, who I think is in every department, I think, have been a really smart pickup. I mean, he's one of many. Adam Wharton, we haven't even touched upon in this episode, which feels quite a shame considering that he's really stole the show elsewhere. There's so many good positives at the moment. And I think it's not just a case of the tactical system and the kind of new chapter under Glasner getting the best out of players. But I think it is the fact that we are getting players coming back and that there are some gaps being filled in the squad increasingly that I think gives us real cause for optimism again. I feel like we always try and intentionally be an optimistic pod because we have to try and look at the positives in otherwise what's fairly bleak sets of results. But it's quite nice to actually be talking about back-to-back wins for the first time this season. I mean, that in itself is crazy, but you know, I digress. There's just so much we could talk about here, but I want to wrap it up with one particular point that we touched on earlier, just to sort of bring it back in. Substitutions. Sam, I'll bring you in very quickly on this just while we close. Substitutions have been something that we've been criticising for a while now. I think fans in particular on socials are a bit up in arms about some of the lack of impact that they're having and some of the personnel that are coming on. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on that quickly. I mean, what do you think of some of the recent substitutions?
Throughout the season, I have felt like it's, bar the ridiculous decisions to sub on players when they are coming back from injury under Hodgson. Even under Hodgson, he was massively let down by our depth and the injury crisis we were going through, and it's still lasting. I'm sure in the best case, we'd have Francher available to give chances off from the bench, but again, he's injured. Jez has been injured pretty much since he started looking bright. So yeah, I think it's hard to really judge substitution choices that we decide to bring on without the context of the players we would want to be bringing on aren't there. I think it's I think the fact that Edouard and Mateta are both back and fit at the same time is a massive help, because neither of them can really ever seem to last a full 90 minutes without completely gassing the tank. And I think you see them coming on quite often. Ayew's been disappointing off the bench, but that is a sub that I have no issues with coming on. Schlupp's been actually looking quite good recently coming on. I'm happy to see Gyro getting chances again, because if there's any manager that would use him, probably would be a manager like Glasner, obviously naturally being a left-sided centre-back at youth. And whilst he is doing his job in midfield at the minute, who knows, give him a pre-season if we decide to extend his contract and maybe he does start to take up his position again back in centre-back. And I think the only real positive from substitutes that I've really been seeing is I'm enjoying how much Hamada has been getting. Give him time. I personally believe that he had a lot of quality to give, and I think he's the sort of player that Glasner's going to end up loving, being the amount of energy he brings into that midfield.
Yeah, good point on Hamada, actually. I kind of called a bit too early by saying I thought he could benefit from a loan. And you know what, maybe I do stick by that a little bit if competition gets too heavy. But I think we've seen him kind of growing into an energised sort of box-to-box role, as well as more of an attacking role under Glasner. He seems quite versatile, and I'm really encouraged by that.
I definitely wouldn't be opposed to him going on loan. He's young enough, and he probably is still slightly too raw for the Premier League. But if he's getting these minutes off the bench, that rawness probably will start to fade soon.
No, definitely. I mean, look, we'll have a squad planning conversation later down the line, probably towards the transfer window. But there were some interesting quotes from Glasner on the fact that contract renewals are not going to actually happen until we're mathematically safe. You know, I shouldn't say renewals are probably a bit misleading. I meant more as in and discussions around renewals and squad planning within the club itself. So obviously a number of players, you know, I mean, you mentioned Gyro, but we've got Will Hughes, Jeff Schlupp, there's so many that are kind of out of contract in the summer. It's not quite the extent that we had a few years ago where it was literally double figures. You know, it was a total clear out of the old guard. But there's still, you know, a lot of question marks over those kind of depth players for a club that already lacks it in the first place. I mean, for the sake of finances, we've got to renew some of them, right? I mean, I would earmark, for example, Gyro and Will Hughes as two players that I would probably give a new contract to, maybe even Jeff Schlupp, actually, who I think is far more effective off the bench when he, you know, has more time to sort of have that energy advantage over his man and so on. But I mean, I just want to just hang it back to you, Sam, for a bit, and then I'll get you in on this as well, Pat, before we really wrap up. Let's say you can only give a contract to one person that is out of contract in the summer. I mean, who would it be for you, Sam?
It's between three, really. Hughes, obviously, probably is the one that is the smart choice. If you're going to be able to sell any of them, it will be him, like later down the line. So just purely keeping value, he's probably the best choice. He's also played really well against West Ham. Maybe he is improving. And again, he plays a pretty decent role off the bench. Then with our track record of signing fullbacks, I'd be tempted to keep one of Klein or Ward's, probably Ward just because of his slightly more natural ability to play a wide centre-back role, despite how impressive Klein has been recently. But then again, I am at heart a Gyro lover, and I would love to see him get his final breakthrough back under Glasner after all these years. So if it's up to me, I would probably go with Gyro purely out of the fact that I love that man.
I love that. I love that. So Hughes for value, Ward for like the experience and the depth, and then just Gyro for pure vibes, and we're back in vibes. I love that. I feel like Pat, you're our kind of statistical, rational expert here. I'm not going to typecast you like that, don't worry, but like, how do you feel about that? I want to get your opinion on that. I mean, who would you actually go for? Jokes aside.
Probably Joel Ward, because he's just gonna play. He's like that serviceable in case of emergency break glass, last ditch central defender now that can play. And you know what you're getting with him. You don't have to worry about putting somebody on the back line that has no right to be there. So I think that's valuable. And I think he's been in the locker room for so long. You gotta keep him.
The locker room, I love that.
Then very American of me. Ugh.
It's almost as if you spent ages giving Chris Richards props again. It's like he's American. I love
Yeah,
it.
that
I
probably
love
gave
it.
it away. That probably gave it away.
No, jokes aside, like a very, very fair answer. Yeah, I mean, I would back Joel Ward purely because I'm questioning when we're going to get that bloody testimonial because it's been way too long and they don't seem to be giving it to him. So I feel like if we actually keep him for the next 1,000 years, there's a small chance we'll actually put one on at long last. And on that strange, weird, and wonderful bombshell, we're going to wrap up there. But thank you very much, everyone, for listening. Really good to have all your love and support. Yeah, if you haven't done so, please leave a review. We really appreciate it. You can leave 1 star, 5 star, whatever you want. Bad, good, it helps us improve. So please, please leave all your comments, leave all your reviews wherever you get your podcast from. If you haven't done so already, you can check us out on X at The Palace Way, and thepalaceway.com is where you can find all our wonderful articles, analysis, and a whole lot more. We even have Joel Wardle. Yep, we've just been talking about him, and it felt quite fitting. If you like your little puzzles and your word games, you're doing your NY Times all the time, that's the spot for the Palace one. Joel Wardle, we have it at thepalaceway.com. All that's left for me to say is thank you very much to Pat and Sam for coming on. Sam, any closing thoughts?
I'm happy that we're fucking back winning games finally. It feels a long time since I've actually been able to say that.
We are so back. We are so back. That first back-to-back wins this season. I mean, I was trying to remember the order of Wolves United, and when I heard that earlier, when I was just looking into the notes for this pod, it was like, oh, it just makes me realize how much of a slog it's been. So this is like a little island in the stream, a little oasis in the desert for us. You know, this is a nice patch. We'll probably get spanked at against Newcastle in a couple of days. Oh well. I hope that ages badly. I hope that ages badly. Really good to have you on, Sam. Really, really good to hear your thoughts. Thank you very much. And Pat, closing thoughts?
Closing thoughts, it is better to have Eze and Elise in the same team together. Let's just keep doing more of that and let's let the rest take care of itself. But really continuing to see us go out there and actually expect to get something from each match and have confidence to take all three. It's an amazing thing to watch. Just enjoy it while it's lasting, because this is Palace. But let's hope we're seeing something that is gonna be continuing for a long time into next season, because I'm enjoying it right now.
No, definitely. We've got to take what we can get as Palace fans. We've all been fans to varying degrees, but we've all been fans long enough to know that Eze and Elise, will we see them, one or both of them, staying in the summer? Who knows? Like it, anything could happen. I think we've just got to enjoy them while we got them. No, very good point. A humbling one as well. Of course, thank you everyone from me. Again, really good to have your support here. Stay safe, up the Palace, and we'll see you in the next one for a double bill looking at all things Newcastle and Fulham. Take care.